The Guardian.
Support for this podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand, or portfolio so easy, it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Ollie Mann. It's half term this week and the summer holidays are tantalisingly close. Back in the day, it was easy. You went to the travel agents, you picked up a brochure, you found a holiday, you went back to the travel agents, you booked it, and a year later you jetted off to destinations unknown, taking care to tell your close relatives the hotel phone number in case of emergencies. Now, of course, you can book your break the day before you leave, stay anywhere from a treehouse to a castle, keep your friends up to date with very tedious minute-by-minute updates about all the cocktails you're drinking, and keep on top of your work emails whilst you're on the beach. But how much of that is really a good thing? And what are the tech do's and don'ts of going on a holiday 2.0? Well, I'll be chatting to the experts, including Airbnb and TripAdvisor, plus hearing tales of holiday woe from our tech team regulars. Stick around, this is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Cast your mind back to holidaying in the not-too-distant past. Everything was simpler. There was less choice, mostly booked through first choice. Of course, the hotel could be a building site, and if the weather wasn't great, then you got through that stack of paperbacks you bought pretty quickly. Thank God for Kindles. Well, to discuss all this, I'm joined in the studio by Airbnb's James McClure and TripAdvisor's James Kay. Welcome, Jameses.
Hello.
Hi. Hello. Plus, we have two non-Jameses. We've got Hannah Jane Parkinson and Samuel Gibbs from The Guardian's tech team. Hi there.
Hello.
Hiya.
Hello. I mean, let's just take a moment to reflect on just how much things have changed. As I say, we are in a completely different world now. Hannah, you've just returned from holiday yourself.
I have. I was in Greece and it was very good. It was very nice. I did take my phone away, did a little Instagramming there. Had to get those filters on my pictures.
Yeah, that's it. How much is a little Instagramming is the thing, isn't it? Our tolerance has changed, I think, to this.
Well, this is true. I mean, Sam and I were discussing before that Instagram is the one thing I think is acceptable on holiday because, you know, the sees very blue. You get your correct filter on. Looks very nice. I'm saying like one photograph a day. But, you know, we were discussing off air about how I've been stung with data roaming charges before.
So have you? Yeah.
Now I will. It was in Morocco, I think, about a year and a half ago. And so now I go and try and turn my data roaming off, turn my any kind of, you know, put my phone on airplane mode a lot. But I did check my work email a few times when I was out there, I have to say.
And that's the thing, isn't it? We're going to be touching on both of those things, actually, distractions and data roaming, a little later on in the show. Samuel, when you go on holiday, and you're looking particularly pallid now, I hope you don't mind me saying, it looks like you haven't been away for a while.
Thank you.
When you do go on holiday, do you do all your research online?
Pretty much, yes. Yeah. And these days, I almost pick my holiday destinations by availability of data services. I know that sounds really sad, but I just can't unplug. I mean, pretty much everything I do is on my smartphone these days. I'm here on holiday, and I even pick up kind of like temporary contracts just to make sure I've got data when I go.
Do you? You do that? So you land on the ground and then you go and visit a mobile phone shop to get a data card?
I'm already there. I've already got it. I've already ordered it. 9 times out of 10, you can get something from the UK, no problem.
Wow, that is impressive. okay, well, let's talk about TripAdvisor first of all with you, James Kay, because most people now, I think, research wherever they're going to stay on TripAdvisor first. Other sites are available and all of that, but let's be honest, it really is TripAdvisor that's dominant in this market. And yet, I've never put a review on it myself. I'm even a bit suspicious of people who do, because I think, why would you go to a place and then come back and write a review? So this wisdom of the crowd thing is quite interesting, isn't it? Why do people trust the opinions of people who aren't like them?
Well, we've been curious as well as to what motivates people to review. And what we've generally found is it's this sort of virtuous cycle. The people who are most motivated to review are often the ones who've actually been on holiday, took particular stock in a few reviews they'd read, had a great experience as a result, and felt compelled to kind of give back to the community that had helped them out. And that's really how the site has grown over the last 15 years. I mean, there's now well over 200 million reviews and opinions. So there are plenty of people out there who are actively reviewing when they come back from holiday.
But is your business model dependent on trying to persuade more people that use the reviews to write the reviews to make it more accurate, or does that not really matter?
Oh, well, certainly I think the volume of reviews matters a lot. Yeah, I mean, the more reviews you have of a place, the more accurate picture you're going to build. So absolutely, we want people to be reviewing as much as possible. But it was almost a happy accident, actually, that reviewing became the model for TripAdvisor. When the founder, Steve Corfer, set up the site, he originally set it up as a B2B tool, and he kind of, almost on a whim, added the how to write a review button, not expecting it to get much traction, and suddenly found that actually that was the bit of the site people were most drawn to, and people were just off their own volition posting reviews. And from there, it's just grown, really. It's just gone with what the community wants. And I think it's interesting you were saying how much travel has changed, and it's actually been quite a recent development. I mean, TripAdvisor was started back in 2000, and really the idea of going online and finding customer reviews was actually pretty unheard of then. And now it's such a mainstay of travel, people are amazed that we never did it before.
I do wonder how many of your users as well are actually looking ahead of a holiday they're about to genuinely take, because I have found myself basically using TripAdvisor as pornography. I mean, I go on there to look at the 10 best beaches and all of that. I'm never going to book those places. I'm going to book a package. But I go and I dream about where I could go to get me out of rainy London.
I would think most people do go on and are genuinely looking for a holiday, but I'm sure there are people who like to stare at nice photos of beaches, which is the other advantage as well, because it's not just reviews people put up, it's lots of photos as well. So you do get that kind of full sense of what a place is going to be like. But yeah, I'm sure there are people who use the site who are just quite keen to look at nice photos of buildings and beaches.
Hannah?
I was just going to say that TripAdvisor saved me last Easter when my sister and I turned up. And this hotel was a complete shithole, if I can put it nicely. And we got there and we were like, oh God, this place is awful. And we was kind of, we had to make a decision as to whether to kind of stay and stick it out or just like move and get it over with. So we were kind of frantically going on TripAdvisor to kind of, you know, see. So we, in the end, we moved on the first day straight away by going on TripAdvisor and seeing, and ended up going to this really nice place, which was great, and saved the holiday. So that was kind of the importance of having a Wi-Fi connection in this place, managing to kind of go along. But I do wonder, when you said about who leaves the reviews, because I always think it's interesting that you say people want to kind of pay back, but I always think people are more likely to kind of slag something off. It's like the way most of our news is all negative. No one's like, it's never front page news that like something went really well. It's always disastrous. And I think I would be more inclined to go on and write about how awful somewhere was rather than, you know, how nice something was. I don't know if that's a...
It's interesting because I think that's a lot of people's perception, that most people who would want to review would be doing so to impart wisdom about a negative experience. Actually, that's generally not what happens. So the average review that's posted to TripAdvisor is just over 4 out of 5. So the vast majority of reviews that people submit are positive reviews. So I think it is much more of that payback mentality than we're just going to go. I mean, obviously, we do have negative reviews as well, which I think are as valuable as the positive ones. But it's much more slanted to the positive experience than people might expect.
Samuel?
Are all reviews written by genuine users, or do you have professional users? Are any reviews paid for, or are there any? Do you have professional reviewers?
We don't have professional reviewers, and the idea
is you fishing for a job, Samuel.
I'm sorry to tell you, we don't have professional reviews. No, we have. I mean, on the forums, we have destination experts, but they are volunteers who usually live within that city and can kind of give travel tips and advice to people going asking questions. But no, the reviewers are absolutely not paid for, and that's absolutely against our rules for it to be that way.
And how do you prevent, say, self-interested parties reviewing their own places highly, even when they're not necessarily fantastic?
Yeah, so we have a whole team that's basically dedicated to exactly that, to kind of sniffing out those people who are attempting to get around the system. And it's usually people who've got a vested interest with a business or a hotel owner or someone like that. And we basically have a kind of fraud detection system that we've got. So there's a system that every review goes through. So that's why when people post a review on TripAdvisor, it usually takes sort of 24 to 48 hours before it actually goes live. And that's just because it's going through this kind of filtering system. And basically what that does is sort of picks out anything that's suspicious about a review And then our team, we've got about 300 of them, actually will then manually investigate that and kind of ascertain whether it breaks our guidelines or not. But there's lots of very clever techniques they use, which I can't tell you, unfortunately, because if we did, it would give a roadmap to
game the system.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But a lot of it's quite similar to actually what banks and credit card agencies use to detect fraud. And it's been pretty successful for us.
And it really can make or break a business for a hotel, can't it, as well? Being number one, certainly, or having a lot of negative reviews, which then they'll say aren't necessarily justified. It's kind of with great power comes great responsibility when you're running this kind of site, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, it does have a significant impact for businesses. We know of lots of B&Bs, I think particularly in the UK is a good example, who have absolutely no marketing budget, and basically they are able to promote themselves to millions of people completely for free by virtue of the great reviews that they get. So I think from that perspective, we would say it becomes more meritocratic. It's all about the service standards you provide rather than the advertising money you spend. So yeah, I think it can make or break a business.
Now, James McClure from Airbnb, you were nodding along with quite a lot of that, because obviously what your two sites have in common is reviews as an engine to drive business. Are the reviews the most important thing when people are choosing a place to stay through Airbnb, or is it the photo, or is it the location, or is it the price? Can you actually say what the thing is that makes someone choose a particular house or flat to stay in?
I think a lot of this is actually about trying to match the style of place that people want to stay in, or the style of holiday or trip that they want to have, with where they want to stay and the profile. So I think the importance of reviews comes in not just this is 4 stars or this is 5 stars, but particularly with an Airbnb experience, of that you have the host who's a little bit of helps you to live like a local and give you that tips as to what the nice coffee shop is around the corner, that you could actually have 2 people rate something very highly, but that you can see from reading the review that one person may be more into, let's say, dance music, the other person is more into culture and galleries, the other person is more a foodie, that for 3 different travellers, they could gravitate towards those different styles of hosts. So it's not just the stamp of quality, but also it helps you to know a bit more about people. And similarly, the nature of like profiles means you can see who it is that you're kind of interacting with and get a feeling if they've got maybe similar opinions to you or not.
And do you similarly to TripAdvisor, obviously without revealing your secret sauce as well, but you similarly have people poring over the reviews to try and weed out things that are perhaps unfair? Because after all, it's personal enough when someone's slagging off your hotel. When they're writing about your home, your taste in decor, your pet cat, it must be very personal for people.
I mean, there's naturally is a right to reply. I think where the difference is to TripAdvisor is that it's like a two-sided review system. So it means that after a trip's finished, as the guest, you'd get an email notification saying, would you like to review your host? But also as the host, would you like to review your guest? And they're only both published if both people publish. So it's a little bit of a double blind system, which means that I think it gives people an opportunity to be both honest, but also constructive. And ultimately, these are things that both the guest and the host has a profile. And that's that nature of reviews as a currency, which I think is the important thing for anyone booking travel online.
But what if someone was a kind of permanently awful host then, and if they just never wrote a review, then they wouldn't ever be kind of called out on it then?
And in the review section, we also have bits that allows people to say, if you want to send something directly to the host and not to Airbnb, you can, here's your text box here. But also the flip of that, here, if you want to tell Airbnb something, but you don't want the host to know. So those are some other ways, which means that you can go for the kind of, I guess, giving people the option as to what style in both like visibility, but also nature, do they want to go down the review path. And obviously the things which come in directly to us, we take action on, as well as if there's sort of consistent poor quality.
I think the two-sided nature of it is quite important as well. I mean, on TripAdvisor as well, we allow the kind of the owner to actually post a response to every review they get. And actually, you can tell a lot about a place by the way that they respond to the reviews. And we know from the research we've done that actually people will place more stock almost in how an establishment responds to a review than necessarily the contents of that review. So it can be a negative experience, but if the owner's kind of responding in the right way, that can actually flip it on its head and you leave with a good impression of that place.
There's also, with TripAdvisor, a sense that people get to the different hotels and locations they're choosing from through social media, through Google. With Airbnb, I imagine that's harder, you know, because if you're typing the name of a town into Google, it's not going to necessarily give you the number one response back, stay in this person's house on Charleston Street. What's the best way for you to attract new customers in? Because it seems like people of our generation know what Airbnb is. My mum has just learned what Airbnb is, but I think it's because she's seen the big adverts. You know, how do you actually bring people to it natively online?
The main reason for the growth has been word of mouth, that people have gone on a trip, they've enjoyed, you know, staying in an apartment in Paris, or they've gone to Bali and stayed in a villa or a treehouse. And certainly the more unusual places to stay generates quite a lot of both people telling their friends, but also Instagram pictures and such like that. That's been, you know, the major way in which we've grown. You know, more recently we've been doing a little bit more of the traditional marketing, and that's, to be honest, in an attempt to get to more people like your mum, and that how she can realise that, you know, staying in someone's home is a pretty legitimate way of travelling. And I think the thing of talking about how much like travel has changed, that's really like how the booking has changed. But I think the concept of both what TripAdvisor represents and what Airbnb represent isn't necessarily that different. So if you're going to go on holiday to New York and you knew someone that lived there or grew up there, you'd ask them their opinion of what hotel should I stay in, what kind of area, what's a good restaurant. And similarly, that when you're, if you knew someone who did live in New York, you might actually ask, well, is it okay if I stay for a couple of days? I'm traveling over there. I'd like to get to know the local area a bit better. And I think that's one of the things that technology has allowed that to happen at a much broader scale than just being limited to the people that you know before you go.
Samuel.
Would you say for Airbnb, what's the bottleneck at the moment? Is it the number of people attempting to stay, or is it the people actually providing their places to stay in? I mean, I know people who have used Airbnb effectively to go and stay somewhere, but I don't know anyone who has opened up their home and actually rented it out.
We've got more than like a million listings around the world in more than 190 countries. London is just an example. We've got about 25,000 hosts in the UK. Two, we find the reason why people look to open their home is it's a mix of the people actually proud of their city and want to kind of help people to live like a local and show them a slightly different side of London than they may have got otherwise. But also there's a financial aspect. You know, more than half of our hosts tell us that they use the money that they get from Airbnb to help them to stay in their home. So, you know, London being one of the most expensive cities around, there's definitely a helping people to stay in the houses which they live and pay those bills is a motivating factor.
But there is an issue, isn't there, with convincing people to be comfortable enough to rent out their homes. I mean, one of the stories that we see repeatedly with Airbnb, you know, just search on Google News, the stories comes up. Here's one from The Guardian. Airbnb host returned to find home trashed after drug-induced orgy. Now, obviously, I'm sure that is the exception rather than the rule.
Sorry about that.
But clearly, you know, this is the issue. There was a sensational story where someone's Airbnb got converted into a brothel and so on and so forth. Exception rather than rule. But if that's the story people read, people are going to think, well, I'm never going to let randoms come and stay in my house. How do you counter that perception?
I think one is with the, I guess, the weight of the numbers of people who've done it. So recently welcomed, you know, our 35th millionth guest across the world. These kind of growth wouldn't be happening without actually sort of real strong work on actually investing to the safety and the customer service. But I think, you know, more importantly, it's about that using some of the trust and review systems to be able to understand that before someone comes into your home, who's actually staying there. So you can, for example, choose to only get booking requests from people who've uploaded a picture of their ID, say like a driving license or a passport, or connecting to Facebook. So you can be confident the person that is coming to stay with you is who they say they are, and also get to know a bit more about them through their profile and discussing beforehand. So I think that's the most important bit, that it's actually not welcoming a stranger into your home. You actually know quite a lot about them and why they're coming before they even come. And then secondly, I guess they understand that staying in someone's home is fundamentally different to staying in a hotel. So even thinking myself that when I'd leave a hotel, I wouldn't wash up the cup if I'd made a cup of coffee in the morning. I probably wouldn't make the bed as I leave a hotel. When I stay in an Airbnb listing, either for work or for holiday, you know, I tidy up after myself. I think it's a different style of experience, and people are respectful of staying in other people's homes.
And the other James, do you see sites like Airbnb, the sharing economy, even though it's built on the same principle as we've been discussing, power to the people, democracy, share information, as a bit of a threat to your business model? Because actually what you're doing on TripAdvisor is you do monetize the links when people book a holiday through you. You are sorting information about hotels and B&Bs, not people's homes. The more people that use sites like James's, the fewer customers presumably come to TripAdvisor.
Well, we actually have a holiday rental section on TripAdvisor as well. So I think it's all about providing as much of the accommodation options and choice that people want. I mean, I think the model that Airbnb has got has worked very well, but I do think it probably appeals to a certain kind of traveller, and there are other people for whom, you know, staying in a hotel is always going to be the option that they take. If you're taking a family of sort of six or seven, very often you might pick a kind of family resort that you're more likely to find on a site like ours. So I think you've got to remember as well that the number of people who are traveling around the world is growing at an incredible rate. I mean, I think it was only a few years ago you had about sort of 600 million travelers a year. You're now over a billion. You know, we know China is a place where travel is becoming a huge thing. So I think there's plenty of markets go around for everyone.
Well, what do you see as the next big thing? I guess that goes to both of you, actually, because, yeah, you talk about China. You were talking about sort of allowing people to feel more comfortable renting out their homes. I mean, deregulation in your case for Airbnb, I suppose, is an issue, isn't it? There are still cities in the world that make it difficult for you to operate.
I mean, certainly making sure that regulation can only try and catch up to technology and innovation, but make sure we've got like productive discussions with a variety of cities about whether it's tourism tax or what housing laws. And I think when you're operating in about 35,000 different cities, there's a nature of different areas. But I think if to maybe sort of preview what some of the things may be coming, I think it's the nature of that people want an experience which is, well, I think it's actually experiences, not features, is what's going to be, is and will continue to be the defining reason as to why people go on holiday and why people travel. I think it's less of the, here's the thing that I'm about to do. It's more that, how did this make me feel afterwards? And be able to convey that through, whether it's through Instagram or through reviews in different ways. So I think that's at least where both TripAdvisor and Airbnb are well placed to be a part of that, like experience versus features.
And James, what about you for TripAdvisor? What do you see coming around the corner as the next big thing? Because the site has evolved a lot.
Yeah, well, I mean, for us, the big thing is personalization, really. It's how do we provide as useful an answer to each individual traveler for what they're looking for? So right now, if you want to know what the best rated hotel in London is, we can give you that answer. But the answer we give you is going to be the same for everyone around this table, even though we all might actually have kind of different traveler preferences and needs. And so for us, it's about using the amazing amount of data that we now have on kind of people's travel behavior and using that to give them the information that's most relevant for them. So I think that's the next stage.
Well, James McClure from Airbnb and James Kay from TripAdvisor, I'm going to rate this conversation that we've had 5 stars. If you could reciprocate on your way out of King's Place and rate the building 5 stars as well, we'd really appreciate that. Thanks. So, you've got your sunglasses, your swimsuit and your Factor 20 all packed away. But you're going to need your e-reader for the flight, and your smartphone, obviously, and your tablet, and your laptop. Oh, and don't forget those various chargers and your travel adapters, and those wireless speakers might come in handy as well. And then suddenly it doesn't feel like a holiday at all. So how is tech affecting our experience of our holidays? And is there anything we can actually do about it? Well, earlier I spoke to Lucy Pearson from Unplugged Weekend, part of a growing trend for digital detox holidays. Lucy, welcome to Tech Weekly.
Thanks for having me.
Now, a year ago, you were in the middle of the Sahara Desert when this idea struck you. How? Why?
Yeah. So I went to the Sahara on a yoga and meditation retreat last February in 2014. And we just didn't have the option of using technology or our phones because there was no signal in the desert. And then I met Vicky there. And when we came back, we were too scared to turn our phones on.
What do you mean by that? Scared of what exactly?
It had been so good to have a break from everything coming in, like our emails and our texts and all of these demands that get delivered to you. Mm. We were really relaxed and we'd really learnt a lot about ourselves and we felt like we'd grown as people. And then suddenly we were coming back to the world where we were suddenly going to have loads of stuff thrown at us again. And we were sort of a bit apprehensive about turning our phone on because that was the mark of coming back to it all.
What's the overarching idea for someone who isn't like you, someone who might have thought to go on a retreat in the Sahara in the first place? You know, why should someone listening to this, who's into their technology, who's using technology to listen to this podcast right now, why should they be thinking, you know, it would be a great break, stop using my phone?
Well, I mean, at Unplugged Weekend, we're not just about taking people's technology away from them. We're just all about getting balance, and we help people to balance their digital habits so they can lead more balanced lives. So it's about managing how you use technology so that it's not constantly controlling you, because at the moment we're all walking around with something in our hand that is telling us what to do. We're constantly responding to texts and calls and emails, and really those demands never stop coming. Mm. But if you can just take a break, you can do things for yourself and start to to go on your own steam a little bit.
And of course, in a sense, if you take this pejorative view of technology, actually that's getting worse because of things like the Apple Watch, which are constantly notifying you with taptic feedback onto your wrist, for goodness sake.
Yeah, that's mad.
Except other people would say, no, that's great. That's a constant notification that I can ignore if I want. I'm always connected. I can choose to manage my digital life. This isn't my digital life leading me. Do you think some people can manage it anyway and some people struggle with it?
Yeah, of course. I think everybody can manage it, but it's sort of crept up on us over the last few years and we haven't really noticed that technology and smartphones especially and screens play such a massive role in our lives. Mm. The problem is now when we do have downtime, because we're so used to all of these demands coming into us, the first thing we do is grab our phone if we're in a queue or on the bus or even on holiday.
How do people feel when they get to the retreat and you take their technology off them? I know you start with a group device surrendering ceremony. How do people respond?
Yeah, I think people get a bit uneasy because it's like a social crutch, and especially in a social environment, we're so used to hiding behind our phones if we're nervous. And that's the really interesting thing. There's always an amazing social atmosphere because people are talking to each other. But it's normal. It's really normal now to feel anxiety and like a hot sweat when you're separated from your phone. And that's everybody. That's normal people. People panic when they lose their phones.
I panic when I lose my 4G signal. I mean, how pathetic is that? But I just think, well, no, I'm not going to be able to Google something.
I mean, these are signs of addiction. And addiction's quite a strong word, but I mean, it does fit with the way that we're depending on our digital technologies.
My dad, when he goes to a Caribbean resort where they are specifically not allowed televisions, makes a point of walking down the beach to the next hotel along and watching the football there. Have people sneaked in mobile phones?
We've never caught anybody sneaking in a phone, and maybe that's something that we'll come across. We did have one journalist that did struggle, and you could see that she was struggling quite a lot.
And what is the penalty for being found with a smartphone about your person?
Yeah, that's a good question.
You need to work it out.
Probably some sort of like forfeit, like a dance or something, probably. Some unplugged antic.
And it would be all right, actually, if you had to do an embarrassing dance in front of real people, so long as it didn't get uploaded to YouTube.
Exactly.
It would be fine.
Exactly. Yeah, we'll do that then, next time.
Actually, that would be the best penalty, would be start tweeting on their behalf.
Yeah. Passwords.
Well, Hannah and Samuel from the tech team are still here. Hannah, what do you make of the digital detox movement? Are you going to sign yourself up?
No, basically. I think it's a very nice idea. I personally could probably never do it anyway at all. Sam mentioned earlier that he always has to make sure of his data plan beforehand. And I just could not live without news and stuff and Twitter. And I need to know what's going on in various parts of the world. I just couldn't live without that. But also I think it's very good saying that you will, you know, this will transform your life in the sense that it'll teach you how to rely on tech less and, you know, you can find a balance. But I do think, okay, great, you can go away for a week and a half and feel very kind of enlightened about your life without your phone. But then when you get back to real life, I think maybe you'd keep it up for about a month, like a kind of, you know, gym routine in January. And then you'd probably fall back into the old ways. So I think it's a bit of a false promise, really. It's a nice idea.
But Sam, Lucy has hit upon a universal anxiety in the modern world, hasn't she? Even if most of us wouldn't go to the dramatic extreme of paying someone to take our phone away for the weekend, I think we can all appreciate that there are times we're looking at our digital devices out of habit, not out of necessity, and we'd all like to be able to balance that a bit better.
Absolutely. I mean, it's got so bad that everybody's getting neck strain and back problems because they're constantly staring down at their phones. Now we've switched to the wrists with smartwatches. I think for quite a lot of people, it is tech overload. It's a habit. I mean, you know, our phones bing and bong to tell us there's notifications, but people check it every 2 seconds. Has something happened? Wait, why have I not got this? It's that kind of like obsession with being connected. And I am totally guilty with this. I can't stand being disconnected. I go on holiday, I must still be connected. I do turn off work, I do disconnect from work, but I can't disconnect from kind of like, well, it's more the internet. It's not even really anything else. It's just I must have instant access to information. Wait, I have a thought. No, I don't know what the answer is. Quick, I must ask Google.
Yeah, and the thing is, and it might be partly what we do for a living, that, you know, our Twitter profiles are kind of half work, half pleasure. Maybe other people's are all pleasure, so they can turn off work just by turning off their work email. But I find if I look at anything online, it drags my mind back into a work frame of mind when I really do want to be away from that for a bit, but I want the convenience of being able to FaceTime my grandma.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I do turn off my work email, but I still triage. I still spam like at least half of it because it's irrelevant. Because when I get, I mean, the problem these days is that you can turn off. You can give your phone off. Don't take any work with you. You get back and you are buried in a mountain of correspondence that you just can't escape from. That's a societal problem. Like, our use of email is some sort of like catch-all for everything kind of. Need to change it at some point, but I don't know what the solution is.
Yeah, I wonder, Hannah, whether the solution is actually when you're on holiday, almost building your tech as admin into your day. So that you, because I did this on one holiday, I was like, every day we were just staying in a resort. Every day after breakfast, I took my laptop down, did 15 minutes of deleting pointless emails, starred the ones that I do when I got home. And I thought, well, that's a little treat for myself when I get home. But now I'm going to clean my brain out of it.
Yeah, I mean, you could kind of compartmentalize it into that bit of the day so you didn't, you know, look when those business people sat around on the pool with those kind of weird things that shield your device from the sun. But it's the information thing more than keeping in contact with people. I'm one of those awful people who, you know, won't reply to a text, but will be on Twitter. And then I get angry texts from people like, oh, you can send a tweet, but you can't reply to my text. I'm like, yeah, because you're boring. But
burn.
Absolute burn there. But yeah, I do think it's kind of, I don't know, it's just something about not having information, I guess, at your fingertips, or just not going, you know, knowing what's going on in the world.
Yeah, and actually, it's a point that you flag up that really we should, of course, mention here on a Guardian podcast, is actually in terms of access to news, and indeed podcasts and radio, it can be brilliant for that. I mean, if you're staying in a place where you want to relax, as in sit around a pool all day, but you're not necessarily sort of taking in the local culture, it's quite nice to have a freshly delivered newspaper to your iPad, isn't it? I mean, that is better than waiting 2 days and buying one for €5.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when it comes to entertainment, kind of the internet is my entertainment these days. Everything is on some sort of screen. I mean, from comics to books to music to video. I mean, I spent one holiday listening to audiobooks. That was pretty good. I mean, it made me the most antisocial ass ever with headphones in all the time, but it was brilliant.
Well, we'll have more tech tips for what you should be doing on holiday and some horror stories about what can go wrong after this.
Guardian listeners get the latest news, but they can also create it. With our sponsor Squarespace, you can easily create an elegant website for your personal brand, online store, business, personal portfolio, or blog. Whoever you are, Squarespace's simple tools and elegant designs make your ideas newsworthy and accessible to any audience. Try it at squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Welcome back. So let's assume you are going to take your phone on holiday with you regardless. How should you be using it? Well, first up, we have telecoms expert Rob Kerr from Uswitch. Hi there, Rob.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the show. Mobile roaming is incredibly confusing. I keep seeing stories that say, on the one hand, it's going to be equalized. They're not going to charge you loads of money anymore. The EU are acting on it. And then I see other stories saying they just had this big meeting in Brussels and they decided actually they're not going to do that at all. What's the truth of it? Should you still be turning off your data when you go abroad?
There was an EU regulation coming into effect this year where EU roaming was about to be abolished, so no more charges for data, for minutes, for text. That has been delayed now, as far as we've seen, since 2018. So at the moment, you still have to look towards having a bolt-on for your tariff when you do travel around the world, especially in the EU.
And what a lot of people do is they rely now on their mobile phone network to get in touch with them and tell them about that when they're actually there. I've been guilty of that. You know, you come out the other side of the Channel Tunnel and ping, ping, ping goes your phone and here's my message from EE telling me what to do. But presumably that's quite a dangerous tactic because you may never get that message and you might immediately start getting charged for stuff that, you know, you haven't got the best rate for.
All this should be done before you leave. Do your own homework. So you pack a swimming towel, swimming costume, you pack sunglasses, and you also look at what roaming add-ons you can get for your tariff. Otherwise, you could come back to a bill shock, as we've seen, an average of £61 a month from a survey we did recently. And with that, you want to make sure that you're covered for both minutes, text and data, because currently there is an EU roaming cap of 50 euros, but that's just for data. So you make some calls, you receive some calls. Even if you don't turn off your voicemail before you leave, you can still be charged for that call, even though you don't answer it, by some of the networks.
And is there any justification after the event, when you look at your bill and it's £61 more than you were expecting, is there any justification to actually write to your mobile phone network and say, but I never got the text message, you never told me, or is the onus actually legally on you?
It's normally on you, but if you can plead to them, perhaps to their better half, you can try and get something back, but I couldn't promise it's going to happen at all times. It really is down to you to make sure you have these bolted on before you leave the country, or as soon as you arrive, opt in, don't opt out. So that 50 euro cap, you're covered by.
And what is the best way to actually research what the different options are? I mean, obviously you're going to say you switch, but what else can you do? Is your mobile phone provider actually giving you that information usually on their website, or do they kind of obfuscate it in your experience? Because after all, this is a lot of profit for them.
It's worthwhile checking off your own back. So call the operator, look online, do some research to make sure you're on the best tariff for when you do go traveling, or even on the best network. There are some networks that offer free roaming in Europe and quite a few countries, 18 with three at Feel at Home, and with ID Mobile, another 22 you can have. So you're covered for your text, minutes and data when you're out and about, and you haven't got to worry for bill shock when you come back to the UK. But you can disable roaming when you go away. You can rely on free Wi-Fi at hotels, at cafes. And just be careful. Just be careful that you won't rack up a large bill.
In the future then, when this actually comes into place and we are actually using our phones more readily in the same way we use them at home when we're abroad, what do you think this actually opens up technologically as possibilities? Because at the moment, as you're saying, you do a lot of your planning before you leave. If you've got your phone with you, people, I guess, will be a lot more spontaneous when they're abroad.
Exactly. You can start to send text messages, data, pictures, Instagram. You can really use your phone as if you'd use it over here without thinking about the cost.
Thanks, Rob. Hannah, have you ever been stung by a big bill?
I have been stung by a big bill. I was in Morocco about a year and a half ago, and I was traveling about the place, so I couldn't always have access to Wi-Fi or, you know, cafes or hotels or places like that. So I did keep roaming on, and I had a bill that was about £250. I think, I
wow.
know, I know, that's like...
From Morocco, that is the price of an extra week of holiday, isn't
right?
it?
Right, really? And at least like, you know, 10 pints of beer in London, so I was not happy. So, that was a bit of a shock, and I didn't contest it because I kind of, you know, knew. And it's not as bad as people, you know, there's always those stories in the mail about, 13-year-olds who've come back with like a £4,000 bill. But yes, it wasn't that bad, but it was definitely taught me a lesson, and now I will always turn roaming off when I go abroad because I do not want to be paying that amount of money.
But Sam, you've already regaled us with your incredible foresight to order SIMs online before you go on holiday, so actually presumably you haven't been stung.
No, the most I ever really pay is what I kind of have a figure in my head before I go away, and it's traditionally about £5 a day. That's my max I'm going to spend, and then I manage to cut it off. Generally speaking, these days you can get for instance, most UK plans come with some sort of bolt-on you can add on, which is typically between £2 and £5 a day, and you can either use a set amount or your own usage allowance that you get in the UK. That kind of works at least in the EU.
Yeah, I was in France last week just for a day trip, and it was transformative just having a text that said, whatever it was, we'll charge you £2 for using this amount of data. We'll tell you if you go over it. I mean, I managed to find my way back to the rental car in about 3 hours more quickly than I would have done otherwise. So,
Absolutely. I mean, it's that kind of the ability to access data on the go really kind of unlock. I believe it unlocks your holiday. You know, you get much more out of it because you can do the things that you would take for granted in your own city. Not necessarily work related things, but find the good places. Go there. Don't get lost. Don't have a row on the road. You know, the days of getting stuck in the middle of nowhere, lost, where two people are fighting out over who can read the map better, are done.
Your holiday sounds like an absolute riot. let's talk about the apps that you should have on your phone and your tablet if you're actually going to go get the data, use the Wi-Fi, whatever. Let's keep price out of it. Money, no object. What are the actually genuinely useful bits of technology to bring with you on a holiday, in your view, Hannah?
In terms of apps, I think, which relates to just what we were talking about, language apps, I think it's worth paying a good bit of money for a good dictionary in that kind of language, especially ones that have phonetic, you know, tell you how to pronounce kind of phonetically, and we'll have someone audio of people saying, because I think that's a great thing to have. And if you don't have data on, then you already have it downloaded, so that's a great thing to take away. Obviously we've said maps, transport maps, things that are like, you know, for the metro in Paris or whatever, those kind of things are really good to make sure you're getting around. I don't know, good camera apps.
I'd throw in something like Google Translate. I've managed to speak my horrible English into it and have it speak something that the other party could actually understand.
Wow.
And that was, I felt like I was in the future.
There's that one as well, isn't there, that accesses your camera that you can kind of hover over a menu and in real time turns the words into English for you. That's mind-blowingly brilliant. What's it called? I don't remember what it's called.
Well, but Google Translate does it.
Google Translate does that now, does it?
Yeah,
I mean, it's a brilliant feature.
It is. Yeah, I mean, it only works in a small subset of languages, but generally speaking, you can find somebody who understands one of them. so you're good to go. I mean, another one of my favorite apps are the kind of like, TripAdvisor or Lonely Planet guides. They're quite good. So like, I mean, you used to go to your, I don't know, so maybe I'm showing my age. I used to go to the library and check one out before I went off on holiday.
Can I say I still do? I actually like a Lonely Planet, even if it's 5 years out of date. I quite like having the book as well. But you're right, you can download individual chapters, can't you?
You can, yeah.
If you're going on the kind of holiday where you're just going to sit around a swimming pool rather than one where you're going to be an adventurer, you actually only want to know about the area you're in. You don't want to spend £15 on the whole book.
Google Maps, for instance, now integrates Zagat. So, Google bought the kind of restaurant review system. So that's fantastic too. And pretty much is built into everything these days. I would say Kayak is one of my absolute musts these days. Whenever I'm going anywhere, you end up flying somewhere. So where do you store your boarding pass or your hotel information, or what, when you have to get where, or the codes that you have to get into? I just email the whole lot to Kayak, and Bob's your uncle. It displays it when I need it. It's brilliant.
That does sound amazing.
Yeah,
I'm going to try that.
Yeah, it's brilliant. Really, really genuinely fantastic. They do all the legwork. You don't have to do anything. You just literally email the receipts to them.
And let's finish off with a real bit of public service broadcasting here at The Guardian. Your golden rule for traveling with tech, Sam.
I have to be a bit of a pessimist here. I believe that there's always a chance your phone's going to get stolen. So back it up. Back up all the data on it and make sure you've got decent security settings, because that would be one holiday ruined if somebody starts draining your bank account or something like that.
Indeed. Actually, and having photo backup so that as you take your pictures, they're backed up as well. Dropbox, things like that can be quite good, can't
they? Yeah, and I hope you've got enough data to cover it.
Yes, okay. And Hannah, golden tip from you.
Golden tip, well, talking of draining, I would say battery. Make sure you bring all of your cables, your charger, your adapter, your lightning cable, because you will be screwed if you have a phone and it's not working and you can't switch it on. Obviously,
we've all been in that situation, haven't we?
Yeah. Yes, so definitely that. And also try not to get sand or water in it. It's never great either.
Phones do not like beaches.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. And thank you to my other guests as well. James McClure from Airbnb, James Kay from TripAdvisor, Lucy Pearson from Unplugged Weekend, and Rob Kerr from Uswitch. I've been Ollie Mann. You can follow me on Twitter at Ollie with a Y, MANN. And the producer is Simon Barnard. Thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next week.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.